By remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. President-elect Joe Biden declared Tuesday that the United States is ready to lead the world, not retreat from it, signaling a marked change from outgoing President Donald Trump's mantra of America first. Biden said the country is ready to confront our adversaries, not reject our allies, and ready to stand up for our values. His comments came as his transition to power gets underway, after a government agency declared him the apparent winner of the 2020 presidential election, even as President Trump continues his long-shot attempt to end Biden's victory. A Trump administration official said the White House gave approval Tuesday for Trump to receive the president's daily briefing, but it was not immediately clear when Biden would receive his first classified national security briefing as president-elect. Biden transition teams are also contacting officials at agencies throughout the government for updates on pending policy issues, as well as to better understand staffing patterns after some departments removed individuals deemed to be at odds with the president's view of a limited government. Also on Tuesday, Biden formally introduced some of the top appointees, including Antony Blinken as Secretary of State, Avril Haines as Director of National Intelligence, and Alejandro Mayorkas as the Homeland Security Chief. Meantime, President Trump has yet to offer a concession to Biden and has not called him with congratulations, even as several world leaders have offered good wishes ahead of his inauguration on January 20th as the 46th U.S. President. For more news, please join us, voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. The Syrian army said early Wednesday Israeli airstrikes hit an area in the southern outskirts of Damascus where military defectors say there is a strong Iranian military presence and the second of such attacks within a week. Military defectors say the strikes targeted a military base close to the Syrian Golan Heights along the border with Israel that had been hit earlier. It's unclear if there were any casualties. Foreign donors pledged they projected $12 billion in civilian aid to Afghanistan over the next 4 years at a conference on Tuesday, but many made it conditional on protecting human rights and making progress on peace talks in a major shakeup for the country's economy. Many donors also put restrictions on future funding, and some officially committed for just the next year. Diplomats said keeping financing for Afghanistan on a tight leash could provide a foreign governments, that is, with some leverage to inject a greater sense of urgency into a halting peace process. As the donor conference proceeded, two explosions rocked an outdoor market in the central province of Bamyan, usually considered one of the safest areas of Afghanistan, killing at least 14 people, wounding dozens more, mostly civilians. The U.S.-based maker of OxyContin, Purdue Pharma, says its guilty plea over its role in the opioid crisis is an essential step to preserve billions of dollars for the settlement it is pursuing in bankruptcy court. Purdue Pharma also said in a statement Tuesday after a federal hearing in New Jersey that the plea will advance the company's goal of providing financial resources and life-saving medicines to address the opioid crisis. The plea is part of a settlement with the U.S. Justice Department that also resolves civil claims. And Niger, the West African nation, observing 3 days of mourning following the death of former President Mamadou Tanja at the age of 82. He twice won election after the country's return to civilian rule in 1999. But was overthrown a decade later after altering the constitution to stay in power. And Britain and France on Tuesday announced plans to ease coronavirus restrictions heading up to the Christmas holidays. A second wave of infections subsides following weeks of lockdowns in Europe. For more news, join us, voanews.com. By remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ethiopia's government-appointed human rights commission accuses the Tigrayan group of massacre.
It's an estimated of at least 600 people that have been killed. So it's an atrocity crime, which may amount to crimes against humanity or even a war crime.
Human rights activists in Uganda criticized an official for his shoot-to-kill comments. An Israeli delegation visits Sudan in step to improve relations. A call for African journalists to be resolute in their work, even in the face of persecution. Nigerian men's involvement is the key to stopping gender-based violence. And Kenyan doctors threaten strike to address safety issues.
If these doctors are not covered, then this strike will kick off until the time that they will be covered.
And a remark this morning about democracy in Africa from the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ethiopia's government-appointed Human Rights Commission has accused a Tigrayan group of carrying out a massacre of members of a non-Tigrayan ethnic group. Chief Commissioner Dr. Daniel Bekele says about 600 civilians of the Amhara and Walkit ethnic groups were killed in the town of Mainkadra with the collusion of the Tigrayan security forces. VOA wasn't able to get someone from the Tigray region to verify the allegations. Ethiopian federal government troops have been fighting Tigrayan forces for nearly a month. Dr. Bekele said the killing was carried out by a Tigrayan youth group called Samri with the knowledge of local police.
This incident happened in western zone of the Tigray region in the context of the ongoing hostilities. The local security forces, which basically includes the militia and police, appeared to be retreating when the federal forces were advancing to the area. And just before they retreated and left the area, it has now become very clear that they have carefully planned and executed quite an atrocious massacre against the civilians, which targeted people on the basis of ethnic identity, and they killed hundreds of people, according to our estimate from the local sources. It's an estimated of at least 600 people that have been killed by beatings, stabbing, strangulation, and some of them shot to death. So it's an atrocity crime executed in a very terrible way, which may amount to crimes against humanity or even a war crime.
You call this a massacre. So why would the Tigrayan youth want to massacre the Amhara or the Walkid?
I wouldn't put it that way. It is not the Tigrayan youth that is doing a massacre. It is a particular informal youth group that identifies itself by the name Samri, which was aided and abetted by the local security structure, which includes the police and the local militia. And this happened in a context of the ongoing conflict, and the security structure from the area was retreating, and they appear to have went on a killing rampage of ethnic groups they identified as enemies. But these are civilians who reside in the area. And, it is it's basically an atrocity crime against civilians perpetrated by a criminal group, but which was unfortunately aided and abetted, as I said, by the local security structure, which was in charge at the time.
Dr. Bekele, as you know, there is an ongoing military campaign in the Tigray region. So how did your commission obtain this information?
The area where this atrocity happened is currently under the control of the federal forces. So we have been able to have unfettered access to the town where this atrocity happened, as it is currently under full control of the federal forces. Although security is gradually stabilizing in several parts of Tigray, we have not had any problem in accessing this part of Tigray region.
There are reports of a humanitarian crisis in the making as a result of the military crisis in Tigray. What do you make of what is happening in Tigray, the conflict itself?
That's a very unfortunate situation, the whole conflict situation and how it has unfolded and got to its current situation is an unfortunate development. And from our perspective as a human rights institution, any such violent conflict or war situation puts human rights at great risk. You know, it leads to deaths, displacement, destruction, and perhaps the most egregious human rights abuses happen in a context of a violent conflict.
Dr. Daniel Bekele is the Chief Commissioner of Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission. You're speaking with us from the capital, Addis Ababa. In the wake of protests in Uganda, where dozens of lives were lost, human rights activists have castigated a government minister who said police will be justified when they shoot and kill protesters. Activists said the minister's words may negatively impact people's participation in the electioneering. As Mogumi Davis Rakariji reports from Kampala, activists also want the minister to apologize.
Uganda Security Minister Eletu Mwine told journalists last week that the police have a right to shoot and kill protesters.
Police has a right to shoot you and kill you if you reach a certain level of violence. Can I repeat? Police has a right, or any security, if you leave a certain level, they have a right to shoot you and you'll die for jail, for nothing.
Tumine's remarks came after over 50 protesters were killed by men in uniform over a two-day period, mainly in Kampala. The protesters were demanding the release of opposition politician Robert Chagurani, also known as Bobi Wine, who had been detained while on a campaign trail, allegedly violating measures aimed at preventing the spread of COVID-19. Livingstone Sewanyana heads the Foundation for Human Rights Initiative, a local NGO that promotes respect for human rights in Uganda. He says the minister's words are unwarranted.
Such a statement and, of course, such actions which are violent against the people have a chilling effect. They cause fear and panic. And the net outcome could be, if they are not addressed, people might shy away from the elections. Because, as we know, people would not want to get into confrontation with the powers that be. They rather shy away and ensure that they are safe.
Sewanyana, who is also a UN expert on promotion of democracy, says such a statement may promote unrest and lead to socio-economic deficiencies in the country. He called for a government investigation into the killings. Umar Nyanzi, who heads Muslim Center for Justice and Law, another local NGO that promotes human rights in the country, agrees. He calls the minister's words disheartening.
The Prime Minister should be on record, should be called on floor of Parliament to explain the actions of General Eletu Mwine. Therefore, we call upon the minister, the cabinet, and whoever that is responsible to come and retract that statement, because it is real poison to the rule of law in Uganda.
Activists say Uganda laws do not grant police officers a right to shoot protesters except for self-defense. However, Uganda police spokesman Fred Enanga says the police cannot look on while protesters attack people and destroy property.
The command is usually given to the commanders, and when the situation is overwhelming, there are also tactical responses that are always made, that you cannot, you don't need to come out and say do this, but the commanders and the senior commanders were always exchanging information.
The Ugandan activists say they will provide free legal services to the victims as part of their effort to mete out justice. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Kenyan doctors are threatening to go on strike next month if the government fails to address their safety, health insurance, and staffing needs to fight COVID-19. The threat to paralyze medical care in Kenya comes after at least 10 doctors died from the virus this month. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan doctors are threatening to go on strike next month unless the government addresses their concerns about safety, health insurance, and staffing needs to fight COVID-19. The threat comes at least 10 doctors died from the virus this month. Speaking to reporters in Nairobi Tuesday, the Secretary General of the Kenya Medical Practitioners and Dentists Union, Chibanzi Mwachonda, said his members plan to go on strike because the government is not giving them medical insurance.
If these doctors are not covered, then this strike will kick off. until the time that they will be covered.
Kenya has lost 32 medical workers to COVID-19, at least 10 of them in the last 2 weeks. The deaths have angered medical workers. Watende Andrew lost his young brother to the disease. His late brother, a doctor, worked at the University of Nairobi. After 7 days in the hospital, he died.
I think the other comorbidities, he was in the category of severe disease. He got the best attention we could, but still, I think because of comorbidities, then he developed hypoxia, saturations which were low, and when they were trying to intubate, then he passed on.
Doctors also complain about not receiving adequate personal protective gear. The union says all their requests are met with silence. Recently, President Uhuru Kenyatta opened a new health facility with 100 beds for United Nations staffers and the diplomatic community. Meanwhile, some Kenyans say they were turned away at health facilities and advised to take care of themselves at home. Mwachonda is calling on the government to employ at least 2,350 doctors and medical workers to attend to the sick in various hospitals across the country.
There is an acute shortage of doctors in this country in each and every county, and our demand is that each county must employ at least 50 doctors to cover for COVID and for the other services. If this is not addressed equally, we shall be on strike come the 6th of December.
The Kenya Nurses Union has also issued a 14-day strike notice. The union is demanding compensation for the families of 18 nurses who died from COVID-19 and salaries for some nurses who have not been paid for months. The head of the National Assembly Health Committee, Sabina Chege, said Kenya cannot afford to see doctors not working during this challenging period.
It's not a unique situation where doctors are feeling they are not being taken care of by the government. And, you know, at what point do you say it's optimal or it's enough? It can never be enough, but people can try, and we can't really manage everything. Let's look at what is the priority. What can we be able to do for now? What can wait for a month or two? Then we can have an agreement. I don't think the fight or the strike will solve anything. We'll lose more lives, and nobody is safe.
Kenya has recorded 77,800 coronavirus cases and 1,400 deaths since March. A parliamentary committee will meet Wednesday with county governors and other officials to discuss ways to avert the strike. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 25th. As COVID-19 lockdowns have been increasing cases of gender-based violence, Nigeria's traditional and religious leaders are urging men to protect the rights of women and girls. The campaign coincides with the UN's International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, which is today, November 25th. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
At an Abuja town hall meeting sponsored by the UN and EU Spotlight Initiative, only Nigerian men, including traditional and religious leaders, were admitted. But the intention was not to exclude women. The 100 participants were there to talk about ending male violence against women. Umar Shafil, a program officer at UN Women Nigeria, is one of the meeting facilitators.
In most cases, when we come out talking about women participation, women ending violence against women and girls, most at times men feel left out for the fact that while they are the perpetrators, and still in some cases there are other male champions that are trying to stop or eliminate the violence against women and girls. So we see this as a strategy to engage men to see themselves as allies to gender equality.
Nigerian authorities say cases of violence against women more than tripled during the COVID-19 lockdown this year. A UN survey shows 3 in 10 Nigerian women experience gender-based violence by the age of 15. But many cases still go unreported due to stigma. Margaret Agu says her brother-in-law raped her when she was 15. But reporting the attack nearly tore her family apart, and she was eventually forced to discontinue the case.
We brought family crisis between my father, my mother, and my in-law, and my sister. My mother was apprehensive, and she doesn't want things like that. So I called off the case.
Ahead of the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women on November 25th, Nigeria launched an e-monitoring platform to gather data and better track the culprits of violence. Also, Nigerian authorities have proclaimed the UN's country director, Edward Callan, and the head of the EU delegation, Ketil Carlson, as champions of women and girls. Nigeria's Women Affairs Minister, Dame Pauline Tallin, presented the awards in Abuja.
With more acknowledgement of honoring them as he or she, they will know that they are invited with full commitment to join in this battle. It's a war. It's a battle that we cannot fight it alone.
While it will probably take some time before the negative trend of violence against women is reversed, authorities say this can only happen if more men take responsibility. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
A delegation from Israel visited Sudan Monday this week for talks aimed at advancing a U.S. brokered deal to establish formal relations. Sudan is the third Arab government looking to improve relations with Israel, with Washington support. Naba Mohideen has reaction and analysis from Al-Qaadarif in Sudan.
Israel said it sent its official delegation to Sudan to firm up the U.S.-backed normalization deal. According to Israeli media, the delegation is part of a small group of officials who are preparing higher-level visits scheduled to take place in a few weeks. A government source told VOA that the Israeli delegation held hours-long meetings with Sudanese officials in Khartoum, discussing cooperation in the fields of agriculture, water, and security. Analyst Osman Mergani says establishing good relations with Sudan is important to Israel, which wants to normalize relations with other African countries as well. Mergani says Israel is aware of Sudan's geopolitical position and its potential to influence the peace deal in Africa. He says Israel is trying to make Sudan a foothold in Africa and thinks this is the Israeli plan in strategic terms. Sudan agreed to normalize relations with Israel last month, following Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, in a deal brokered by U.S. President Donald Trump. As part of the deal, the U.S. agreed to remove Sudan from its list of state sponsors of terrorism, a move that may allow the country to obtain loans from institutions such as the World Bank. Observers are concerned the Sudanese people might reject ties with Israel due to public support for the Palestinians. Some, however, like 24-year Isra Ahmed, are welcoming Sudan's changing foreign policy. Ahmed says, as Sudanese, she doesn't mind Sudan having ties with any country as long as Sudan gains economic benefits. She says people are fed up with being part of nonsensical ideological wars and only look for the good life. The Sudanese economy is struggling under the impact of COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, and a budget deficit of $1.6 billion. Last month, Israel and the UAE sent a $5 million shipment of wheat to Sudan and said they looked forward to helping their new friend. Naba Mohideen for VUA News, Al-Qaadarif, Sudan.
The Zimbabwe journalist who is facing charges for revealing corruption says African journalists who might find themselves in similar situation should be strong and resolute in carrying out their duties, even in the face of threats of arrest and incarceration. Hopewell T. Ono says sometimes going to jail and sleeping on hard floor and being denied access to clean water are some of the sacrifices that journalists must make in their effort to reveal high-level corruption, which he says is destroying his country and Africa as a whole. T. Ono was first arrested in July this year, along with Jacob Ngarivombe, leader of the Transform Zimbabwe movement, for allegedly calling on Zimbabweans to demonstrate against poor governance. He was released on bail with the condition not to tweet anything that has to do with protest. Chigono says the real reason for his arrest was because of his investigative reporting exposing corruption.
The first time when I was arrested on the 20th of July, they said that they were arresting me because I had incited violence, but I had not incited violence at all. All I did was to commend an activist who was putting together an action of plan for a protest, which is enshrined in our constitution. We are allowed to protest. And this protest was against corruption. The link to myself was because I had done an investigation and exposed that high-ranking government officials, including those related to the president, were involved in a COVID-19 scandal where $60 million was being looted. And this ended up with the health minister being fired. So I was arrested and I spent 45 days in maximum prison and then I was released. Then the second time, it was on the 3rd of November when I was arrested. I got a knock at my door, and it was the police, and they said that they were arresting me for violating my bail conditions for the first charge, which I've just related to you. They were saying that through my work as a journalist, I had said that I had information that the president's niece, who had been arrested at the airport trying to smuggle 6 kilograms of gold to Dubai, was going to get bail and opposed by the National Prosecution Authority of Zimbabwe.
So you are out, Hopewell, you are out on bail, and part of your bail condition is for you to stay away from Twitter. Now, what do you think about this?
No, my bail condition doesn't say I should stay away from Twitter. I've got two bail conditions now, which are attached to the first charge from July and the second charge from November. The first bail condition says that I should not tweet about anything that involves violence or massive protests. Then the second condition, which relates to the bail that I was given on Friday by Justice Tawanda Chitapi, says that I should not tweet anything that undermines or obstructs justice. So I'm allowed to tweet, and I'm active on Twitter because this is a platform that we use, especially here in the developing world, where mostly the state controls the newspapers and it controls television and radio. So they are trying to control the narrative by removing us from Twitter, by throwing us into jail so that we don't do our work.
What message do you have for journalists in other African countries who might be experiencing the same problems that you are experiencing in Zimbabwe?
My message to my colleagues across the continent who are facing the same kind of repression that I'm facing in Zimbabwe is that you have to stay strong. We went into journalism understanding the difficulties, and sometimes we have to pay a huge sacrifice, like in my case where I go into prison, I sleep on the floor, I don't have access to clean drinking water. I'm staying in a settlement for 16 people, and yet we are 46. These are the sacrifices that we have to pay. And my attitude is that I'm 49 years of age, so my generation's future was destroyed a long time ago. So I'm now thinking about the future generations, and this is my contribution to the future generations to say at least the very least I can do as a citizen and as a journalist is to try and stop or slow down, if I can stop, the levels of corruption that have destroyed Zimbabwe and destroyed Africa.
Hopewell Tiono is a Zimbabwe investigative journalist. He was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has nominated Linda Thomas-Greenfield to be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Thomas-Greenfield has more than 35 years of diplomatic experience with postings in Swaziland, Pakistan, Kenya, the Gambia, Nigeria, and Jamaica. She was U.S. ambassador to Liberia and the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Before the November 3rd U.S. election, our colleague Shaka Saleh spoke with Linda Thomas-Greenfield about U.S. policy in Africa. She says term limits have helped empower democratic processes.
And in some countries, there are no term limits in their constitution. And so you have presidents that go on for years and years. But what I would say is where we've been successful in the international community, and particularly in Africa, is that elections have been accepted as one mode of limiting terms. I think the next step in that process is to ensure that elections are free and fair and transparent, and that incumbents don't use the election to continue indefinitely.
Thomas Greenfield said more and more world powers are engaging with Africans as the continent shifts towards more sustainable development.
All of us are seeing that shift gradually happen. And I think with the resources that are obviously available on the continent, and among those resources are the people resources. Africa is the youngest continent in terms of its people and its population. And we're seeing those young people begin to take more control over the narrative of what is happening on the continent.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who has worked for Republican and Democratic presidents, says there is a shared appreciation in both parties for the importance of Africa. And that's it for this Wednesday, December 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, hoping that you will have a very good day.